This is David Moore, recorded at his home in Radlett, Hertfordshire, by Felicity Aston on the 26th of October, 2010.
You came to the end of your season in Antarctica and it was time to go home. But what happened? Was there a handover with a new team of men to come in and look after the SW?
In essence, that was what was happening. We'd had several men go. Ray Cooper had gone back, I think when the new John Biscoe was coming around on its first visit around the bases, Ray was going back to some other base, and I can't remember which one, and we had a second man, whoever his name was, I forget his name now, the one with the baseball hat. I don't remember his name, but he was a very cheerful character. He kept us up all night arguing, though. He was a Lancashire lad, and he wouldn't give in to any argument. He had to win everything. And he was right in the end, because we were all arguing about what the OBE stood for. And I can't remember the details, but he was right, and we were all wrong. And we were rather cross with that, because we were up awfully late. But one or two others came in. Eric came in, and one or two others John McDowell, I think it was, another Met man, came in, and he was a good lad. They were all good chaps. Eric had been a paratrooper, but I think he had somebody had died back home after he had been landed with us, and in the end, as we were going back to Port Stanley, we were told to go back to Base W and pick him up and take him, and he flew back home to whatever had happened, you know. But he was good for a couple of months. So that period of January then, after the December, January was a period of people moving around a bit. And in the February, my time was up. I was only there for a year. John was staying on for a year at Base W. I'm not sure about the others. Tom had gone by then. I can't remember where he'd gone to. Tom had sent me a telegram at base to say when the Duke was here, he gave me a photograph of himself signed to Tom Murphy. And David, I haven't taken it with me. I want you to go back into the Base W, although it had been handed over to the new base leader, who was another naval officer, actually, Erskine, his name was. And he said, I want you to go and get that picture for me and somehow get it away from the base, bring it back, and I'll meet up with you in England and you'll hand it over to me. Fair enough, I said, that's your orders. And I went ashore on a very rough night, the last night, you know, we were moving out. I'd been on the ship for some time then, and we were going around the bases, loading and unloading, back to the old routine again. And I said to Mr. Erskine, I forget what his naval title was. I said, there's a picture here of the Duke, which was given to Tom Murphy, and I am instructed by Tom Murphy to take it away and give it to him because it's his property. Oh, no, he said, that belongs to the base. No, it does not. And we had this little discussion, and in the end, because he couldn't care less, really, and he said, all right, then, take it. And so he and two or three of his mates found it and said, all right, if you must, take it, you know. And it was all a bit naughty, because it wasn't Tom's at all. It was given to the base, but I thought, Tom is my leader, I would get it for him. And with the carpenter on the ship, we'd made a sort of like a map container, and I shoved it into that, and I'm frightened to death going back onto the ship, because it was really bad weather then. You know, the sea was all over the place, and it was a matter of leaping for your life when you got back to the ship. Anyway, we were on board, and I brought it all the way home, all the way through customs, and handed it to and Eric and Tom came down to see me in Lee. And Tom said, before we go, we've had a nice cup of tea and whatever, but before we go, I want that photograph. There it is. There you go. He said, do you know what I'm going to do with it? I've been ordered to send it back to Base W. And I said, Tom, you idiot, why did you get me to take it? He said, well, it was worth a try. So that was the end of that.
So how did it feel to be, you know, this base you built with your own hands and those people around you, how did it feel to then be passing it on to the...
It was not nice. It was our house, our home, and these strange men had come and were taking it over, and we didn't feel right about it. But it was done in the sort of a, broken up by the one or two changes that we'd had. But we, whilst it was nice to see new people, we were a little bit offhand with them, undoubtedly, you know, for the first few days, until we got the measure of them and they'd got the measure of us. And we're all pals together after that, so that was no problem. But when it finally came to my relief and I had to go on that ship and go and leave the base, no, I felt quite sad. I really did. You know, just in the same way that I felt sad when I'd seen the old Briscoe go around the corner and leave us, you know. But I was looking forward to getting home, and so it was the first step on the way home, so I had that to look forward to, you know. As it was, I didn't get married when I got home. It was 1959 before I got married. And then, of course, as you know, 58 went quite well for that lot. For 57, 58 went quite well. But by the time the relief for 1959 came, the ship couldn't get in. It was 30 miles of sea ice all the way around, and they all had to go sledge out to the ship, which the story I'm sure you've heard from other places. But funny enough, with the dog that escaped from that and was eventually found his way down to Base Y, was one of the dogs, Steve, that we'd brought back on the boat, or tried to bring back on the boat, which nearly got drowned with Ron and me.
So it's a dog with nine lives rather than a cat. Right?
Yes, that's exactly it.
So what were you most, as you were leaving, what did you feel most proud of leaving that base? Was it setting up the radio station or the building of the base? Or was there one thing in particular that you felt particularly proud of?
I don't think I sat down and thought, I'm proud of this or I'm proud of that. I really didn't. But I knew that a very happy chapter in my life was finishing, or about to finish, and I couldn't. I'm looking back on it now as a man of sort of 55 years ago. You know, I was a young man, and I'd enjoyed the experience, even though it had been frightening on occasions. But I'd enjoyed the experience of being with a bunch of lads, and we worked as a team. That was important. I'd never experienced that before, and only rarely experienced it since. I have once or twice, but so that was one major thing to me, that I was losing that. Even though we had a voyage in front of us with a lot of new blokes and new stories to tell each other. I was also extremely proud of the fact that I thought I wouldn't be able to set up a radio station, but I had. With its shortcomings, maybe, yes, but some of them weren't mine, but with my shortcomings and the shortcomings of the equipment, I was distinctly proud of the fact that I'd been able to do that. Because if anybody had told me before I'd gone down that you would have to set up a radio station, I'd have said, no way, I'm not going. And that's the truth. Because it would have been beyond me to think of being able to do it. But when you're faced with things, you just get on and struggle on. And I was helped a hell of a lot by Ray and Eric, you know, in doing the wiring and fitting all the valves in the right places. And, you know, these are old valve sets. I mean, the old transmitter stood about 6 foot high. So you can imagine what damage was done to it all when it fell 30 feet down into the hold. It may have been 25 feet. I didn't see it, but it was bad enough because a lot of it got smashed. So that was the thing I was particularly proud of. And I was also looking forward to going home, of course. You know, and thank goodness I haven't got to stay another year. That was the other little bit of it, because I personally did get a little bit fed up with the routine, I suppose, because it was very much routine. Even though I loved cooking, I hated the stress of cooking, knowing that there were seven lads out there who wanted a good dinner and that you had to do it, like the stress on any chef, in other words, which must be, you know, like this. I wouldn't go and work in any restaurant at all, ever, because, you know, the stress of producing good meals at the right time. I do a lot of cooking here, but it's all right within the family, you know, I can do it. And I do very good food. And even though I say it myself, I shouldn't really be saying these things, but I can cook pretty well now, and I serve up a good Sunday dinner. And I don't do any tiddly bits like Eric used to. He used to make cheese twiglets for tea, you know, and they were marvellous, better than anything you can buy in a shop. And donuts as well he used to make, and I tried my donuts and nearly set fire to the hut. But anyway, that was one thing that we always had to be worried about, and you know, fire has caused serious, horrible damage in the past in Fid's huts. I don't know whether they're all timber now, but mostly metal, I suppose, aren't they?
Mm. And how do you feel that your experiences in Antarctica, I mean, you're only there for a year, but what kind of impact did then that have on the rest of your life and the person that you became?
It had a huge effect. Let me think. When I came back, I knew that we wanted to get married, and that was that. I wanted an outside job of some kind and not go back into a wretched office, which was, I went to a grammar school, and for all those below a certain level, they said, you know, 40 miles up to London, go and do a work in an office. And that's all the career's advice I ever had, you know. And I thought, this is stupid. I'm not going back to work in an office. So I thought, right, forestry, agriculture, farming, whatever. And in the end, I thought, I'm going to go far, you know, go into the agricultural trade. What I really wanted to do, and I didn't have the money for, and this shows you the sort of ridiculous amounts I'm talking about, but I just didn't have any money. I think I had about £100 when I came back, and that was all. But what I really wanted to do was go to a wireless training school, and there, I knew of two in England, which I could have gone to and learned how to do the job properly, you know, of all that I had done, as it were, not just sending Morse and receiving Morse, but doing the whole job, knowing a lot about the technical side. And I thought, I made inquiries, and it was going to cost £400, cash down, more or less, you know. I mean, there were no ways of doing it by saving. And so I couldn't do it. I didn't have £400, and I didn't have anywhere to borrow from. My mum and dad didn't have any money, and you know, and the bank banks weren't going to lend £400 to a wanderer with a big beard. So I put that aside, and I worked then as a farm labourer or a cowman on a farm near Southend where I lived, and I used to cycle 5 miles to it at 5 o'clock in the morning to do the first milking, and 5 miles back at night, and I was exhausted most of the time. Then that enabled me to go into and take a year's study at Riddle Agricultural College, and I came out of there with a certificate in agriculture, and then from there on I started to get better and better jobs in farming, mostly in pigs. But it helped me to, you know, the experiences helped me to have the confidence and the courage to do that and learn new things all the time. I'd never been, you know, I could always think back and think, well, I learned a hell of a lot while I was down south, a hell of a lot about myself, about other people, about how to do things, and don't stand looking at it, do it, you know. And this is what helped me through a year of damned hard work farming and study afterwards, a year of study, which I hadn't done before, really. I didn't do any study in school. I used to mess about too much. And so then, and hard work. I wanted to be a manager of a farm, and I eventually got to be a manager of a big pig unit, and that was great. I was in charge. I could tell people what to do, but I still found there was loads of heavy work to do. But I was in the fresh air most of the time, a lot of the time anyway, and that's what I wanted to do, to be doing a physical, practical job, not sat in an office. By that time I was married. Of course, we got married in 1959. And that was great. We moved first of all up into the Midlands, and then moved to various. We bought a house up in the Midlands, an old Georgian house, and we had Charlotte and I put it all together. It was dropping to bits, and we put it all together, and eventually sold it for about 3 times what we'd paid for it, which again, we'd bought it for about 1,700. Ridiculous, isn't it? And we sold it for about 4,000, or just over 4,000, something like that. Anyway, and we thought we were the cat's whiskers, because by that time I had farmhouses to live in, you know, so I didn't need the house. I worked for the Farmers Weekly, which again I thought might lead to a journalistic career, but no way, they weren't having farm workers or pig managers coming to work in the nice office in London. It was the wrong decision, I shouldn't have gone there. And after about 6 months to a year, I said, right, I've had enough of this, I'm going. And they said, well, go then, you know, because I hadn't got on too well with them. And then I did another thing in which I was helped tremendously by my service in the Antarctic, because I looked in the Farmers Weekly magazine, which had various jobs, and become a loss adjuster, it said. I don't know what a loss adjuster is, but I'm going to have a go. And it was, well, you know what a loss adjuster is, he adjusts insurance claims. And the firm that I went to in the end had all the NFU work, the Farmers Union insurance work. And so that's why they wanted farmers or people with agricultural experience. So I went to the interview, and there was a great bunch of people there wanting to be loss adjusters. And I was able to tell them all sorts of rubbish about the Antarctic and stand up and look them straight in the eye and shock them where it needed.
And that helped you get the job.
And that helped me get the job. And I regretted that after about 6 years. I said, oh, enough of that. I got fed up arguing with old ladies about their decorating, you know. So then I saw a job, and again on a box number, I've replied to it, and Lloyds of London wrote back and said, come and see us. And that was as a risk surveyor, which I did until I retired. Well, not until I retired, but, you know, for about 30 years. And then I had my own small company just for the last 2 or 3 years. But there again, you know, I sat there and told, it was a lady who was interviewing me for the job at Lloyds, and I told her all about the Antarctic, and she said, well, the chairman of Lloyds came in and sat down and said, I've just come to listen in, you know. And she said, well, this is Mr. Moore, and he's going to join us. And I thought, well, nobody's asked me yet, but if she says that, that's okay. And I'm not.
I just quickly wanted to ask you, hopping back in time a little bit, back to the actual hut,
right.
BASW. Once you built it, was it successful as a place to live? Did you have, what was it like to live there?
It was quite a good home, yes. It very quickly got covered in snow, or virtually covered in snow, as the winter came on. By then, we were in full occupation. And as you went in the front door, if you turned left, there was a sort of long corridor along the front of it. And if you turned left, you went past the dormitory, I suppose, in a civilised world, you'd say dormitory, but the bunk room or whatever, with all the bunks, apart from Headley's, which was up in the loft. And beyond that was the big water tank and the big room, which I think we called the sledge room, but that's where we had the bath. And if the year had passed, you knew you had to have a bath, but that's not what the pilots thought. But no, seriously, it was down to you to go and get the snow. If you wanted a bath on a Saturday night or a Sunday night, you had to trudge backwards and forwards, filling up the tank with snow, and get that all melted so that you had enough water to heat up, and then you would have your bath. Beyond that was the diesel generator, which was Ray's kingdom, and sometimes. He installed the generator, and he was just brilliant at things like that. And he could start it with one swing. You know, he had that sort of muscle. And we also, for the first few months, we had a sort of explosive thing which we put in to a little slot, and you wound up the thing as fast as you could, and then it went bang like that, and then it exploded into light, and then the diesel was going, and that was producing all the electricity, great and stuff, you know. We ran out of the explosives before long, you know, and there it was just a matter of hoping for the best, keep winding up. Ray could do it because he had the muscles of a caveman, you know, boom, 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 and it would all go. But sometimes he said, David, I don't want to do it on a Sunday morning. And he said, I've had a few beers. He said, you do it on Sunday morning. And I used to get really wound up into it, and I had to get it going for my early morning sked. and to get the get everything going, you know. So I used to wind it up and wind it up, and in the end it would go. But one day it just wouldn't go. And I got in such a temper with it that I kicked it and nearly broke my ankle, kicked the diesel engine. I just nearly broke my ankle, and I hobbled all the way back to the radio room, because I think shortly afterwards, I think Ray, if I remember rightly, Ray heard all the kerfuffle and came and started it for me. But anyway, we got the radio going, and that was that. So I think after that he decided he'd get up on Sunday mornings, because he couldn't have me hobbling about for the rest of the year. That was that. That was the diesel room. So coming back then, to passing the bunk room again, and then there was a big general living room, which was where we all met during the evenings, if you like, and there were books and the gramophone record of ancient make, and that's where we wrote letters or played card games or something like that, and it was the general amusement room. Next to that, I think we had offices, with Tom's office as the base leader and the surveying office, if you like. Beyond that was the kitchen, so therefore we've come in the front door. All that down there is the bunk room, we've got the living room, offices, and turning right along there we got to the kitchen, which was quite a big room, but not as big as the bunk room, obviously, or the general amusements room. And there, over there was an Aga cooker, which was the first time I'd ever seen such a thing in my life. But it was a brilliant cooker, it really was. And I can quite see why they're so popular now. And a big water tank in there, and a table for all our meals and all that, and the store cupboards for all the food, which was mostly tinned and quite varied. You know, lots of tinned fruits and tinned meat and loads of flour and lots of butter, because we liked... It was the proper thing to do, to put about half an inch of butter on your bread, because it helped you. This is what we were told anyway, you know, this is the right thing to do. It builds up your reserves of fat, and then you can deal with the cold weather better, which we always found to be a very good excuse. And beyond that, on the front, if you like, of the hut was the radio shack, radio room rather. Beyond that was the met room. And then in that corner, I think it was the toilet sort of area, which was a bit of a den of a, you know, horrible area, because that all had to be carried out the next day, you know, or the next day afterwards. So that was that. So to bring any water in, if you were the cook, you had, I think you got a gash hand to help you with getting water in for the, if you were on cook that week. So, you know, we were all gash hands, and anybody was around did it. That's one thing. Nobody ever argued about what they had to do. You know, we saw things, knew that it had to be done, so we just did it. You know, not like my son, not like my grandson, whose favourite question is why. That's Sam. He used to be a lovely little boy when he was about that size. Now he's 15. Why?
you mentioned that your fire was a big hazard, because obviously the building was made of wood. Was that something that you were constantly aware of, the risk of fire?
Well, I was, because I know when I was repairing the transmitter at different times and various things, I can't really remember what I used to do, but I used to sort of create a bit of heat in there at times, and I was always a bit unhappy about that. We had fire extinguishers around. I think at some stage Tom had said to me, right, you're in charge of the fire extinguishers, and I said, all right, Tom, and I don't think I thought another thing about it. You know, I thought, well, we'll put one here and we'll put one there and put one there. I'd never thought much about it. And you know what? When I was working for Lloyd's as a risk assessor, I used to go around very importantly saying, you have not got enough fire extinguishers. You need one there, one there, one there. You need everything done properly or you'll get no insurance. And I'm the man that didn't know a damn thing about it and didn't care too much when I was in the hut. It wasn't something that we gave a lot of worry to, but you know, we knew that the kitchen was safe. We knew that the heater was all safe. It was all strapped in by asbestos, if I remember rightly, which again is another hazard that's only just come up in recent years. I sometimes worry about my breathing with it all when I think about it, but anyway, that's beside the point. It worried me more when we were laying insulation in the loft, because it's still the same stuff as you have in your house now, but I mean, we had the guys in to do the free insulation in our house, and I couldn't even go into the loft because all these dusty hairs hanging around. But then we had masks, as I remember, but we couldn't work. You know, we crouched down trying to walk along these little beams in the roof, and rolling out sheets of this fuzzy stuff, you know, and insulation stuff, and it was terrible. I must admit that. Remembering back now, it did affect my breathing then. But at least I didn't have Ron Millick smoking fags all over me.
Did you have many accidents during your winter? Was there many sort of general accidents?
No.
Yeah?
No. I don't know why not. We weren't particularly careful about things. We just were lucky, I suppose. My accident to my foot was self-inflicted, and I wasn't going to report that to anybody apart from Ray, who thought it was a good laugh. But that's how we saw things. You know, things went wrong, we all had a good laugh and put them right. And that was the story of BASW in its first year, really. But no other accidents at all. Nobody fell in the water. I don't think anybody fell in the water, or nobody fell through the ice or anything like that. Nobody fell off the roof or anything. Well, now, after the Prince Philip had left us, and got back to the luxuries of the royal yacht Britannia, he, after a few more drinks, I should think, said to his wireless operator, "Kindly send the following message," and I'll read it out to you. "Please pass to Base's Whiskey," which was BASW, of course, "Foxtrot, November, Alpha, Oscar, Bravo, Golf, from Royal Party Britannia. I have received the following from His Royal Highness the Duke of Edinburgh. Begins, I thoroughly enjoyed each of my rather short visits to bases W, F, N, A, O, B and G, and I am most grateful for your hospitality on each occasion. It was most interesting and instructive to hear about your work, your bases and all the various activities. I was most impressed by the obvious good spirit at all the bases, and also by the very high standard of housekeeping. Many congratulations to you all. I send you all my best wishes for the new year."
Fantastic.
And we think that he was taking a rise out of us, because he knew that we'd been up all night scrubbing everything in sight, and that was the high standard of housekeeping. Now, the other thing I'm going to... am I still going? Yeah. Well, now, this is something that I've only recently come across and only recently read. I read a book by, oh dear, I've forgotten her name now, but anyway, she's recently written a book called The Longest Winter. I can't remember her name, sadly. I might be able to tell you by the time I've finished. Anyway, six men were sent off from Scott's camp, Scott's base, to go and explore north and east from there, while he was concerned with going south to the pole. And there were six men, two Royal Naval officers, one geologist, whose name will be known to everybody except me as I'm standing here, sitting here, and three seamen, who were all good quality seamen, but off the lower deck, as they used to call it there. I suppose they still do. But anyway, to cut a long story short, they did their first winter, and then for one reason or another, and I'm not going to go into that now, they had to provide for themselves, because nobody came to pick them up at the right time. So they decided that they'd better look after themselves. And so they had to, if you read the book, you'll know all about it, and it's well worth reading. But they had to hack out a cave in the ice to live in, and then scrounge whatever food they could get after that. And it was a pretty awful ordeal for them until that winter passed and they were able to travel back to the Scots camp again. One of them was Dr. George Murray. He was a Royal Naval doctor. and quite a quirky sort of character. And in his diary in the ice cave, dated 1912, during his second unintended winter, he wrote the following, a little poem, which is good fun, I think. And they had a far harder time than we ever experienced in the Antarctic. Much, you know, these were real men to live through it all. But he wrote, "A for Antarctica, all frost, ice and snow, the place where all half-witted explorers all go. B for the word they most frequently use, though not, we admit, without frequent excuse." And I thought that sums everything up.